Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guest house overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission.
Well, here we are in Nashville at the mothership of Tennessee history. Tell us about where we are and who you are.
Well, we are at the Tennessee State Museum, located in downtown Nashville in the Bicentennial Mall. My name is Annabeth Hayes, and I am the curator of decorative arts here at the Tennessee State Museum.
Your little mall area here is one of the best-kept secrets in Nashville. It's kind of like the Parthenon.
It really is.
You know, just kind of out there a little bit, not right in the heart of downtown.
It's a state park. The museum's here, mm-hmm. The new Tennessee State Library and Archives, and we also have the farmer's market. You have a whole day spent just hanging out in the Bicentennial Mall.
But you need like a big neon arrow downtown,
right,
pointing people in this direction. And it is walkable.
It is. Yeah. So you can walk between all of those sites. You can go for just a nice walk after lunch through the mall. And there's parking, which is always great downtown. Mm-hmm. So it is a best kept secret with the parking, especially.
It really is. In the Tennessee State Museum, it's also the mothership for kids that grew up in Tennessee, their fifth grade experience.
It is. So we have a ton of school groups who come to the Tennessee State Museum, like you said, because Tennessee is part of the curriculum for mm-hmm. fifth grade, or Tennessee history is. And so we're so glad to be seeing school groups back in the museum after the past couple of years. And then it's always nice when their parents are with them and they can remember coming to our old location, which is located in the TPAC building.
And you had an older location before that.
And we did before that. It was in the War Memorial building.
Down in the basement.
Again, and we're glad to be above ground now. But yeah, the Tennessee State Museum actually, I don't know if many people know this, but started in 1937 uh-huh. as an act of the Tennessee General Assembly. We moved to the TPAC location in 1981, and we're in our new location as of 2018.
So you were able to build in some state-of-the-art stuff here.
A ton of interactive opportunities for students here. They can scroll through and see photographs that maybe we can't have on display. They can do activities. We have a whole children's gallery for children's programming. We have a digital learning center where we host lectures and events for adult programming. So it's something really for the whole family.
And a little bit about your background and what you do here.
Sure. Like I said, I'm the curator of decorative arts. I'm responsible for things like furniture, silver, ceramics. I've been at the museum since 2019. Before that, I was with the Tennessee Civil War National Heritage Area as a research curator. So I'm from Tennessee. I'm from West Tennessee in Jackson. Tennessee history is something I've always loved. I remember doing Tennessee history core curriculum in fifth grade.
Yeah.
So I think it's something I was destined to do.
That's really cool. And what got you hooked on decorative arts?
The stories behind it. I really love the idea of an object just holding a story. And I love 18th, 19th century history and kind of bringing that to present and how that affects where we are today. And so I really love looking at the people behind those objects, who made them.
Their art is a metaphor for their...
a lived experience, yeah.
And who they were and their brain and what things they were fascinated by the things they choose to decorate on their...
Right, or the kind of what we talked about when we were going through the galleries, that idea of people may not know the many hands that made something. So, for example, pieces of furniture, they may not realize that there is a name associated with a piece of furniture, but then that person in 1800 probably had enslaved people who were also trained craftsmen who were working on those objects as well. And then thinking into the 20th century, who made it, who used it, who cleaned it, all the many hands that have touched the objects that we are lucky to have in the museum today.
And then we were talking earlier about, so you're in a small town in Western Tennessee and
right.
you're making this cool work of art. How do you market it? How do you let the world know?
Right. I loved that conversation we had talking about the trade networks in Tennessee, talking about in the late 18th century, early 19th century, you have the Great Wagon Road, which spans from southeastern Pennsylvania, the Philadelphia area, into Virginia, western North Carolina, eastern Tennessee, eastern Kentucky. And so you have this network, this trade network that's going on. It shows the importance of newspapers at the time to get the word out, advertisements. And so you have people writing to one another, advertising what they're doing, what they just bought from someone. You know, people like to show off. They'd mm-hmm. like to show off back then, too.
Mary, you think about just these processes that you could get on your little iPhone and go to some site and put an ad up for your
right.
business today in 1 minute. Where these people had to get in their horse or buggy or whatever.
Very dedicated.
And ride, what, maybe 50 miles to the nearest town with a newspaper of any.
Right. We have a select group of objects upstairs related to this man called George Rylstone, who was Tennessee's first state printer. And he traveled into Tennessee on that Great Wagon Road. And he brought his printing press in a wagon across the Appalachian Mountains into East Tennessee.
Wow.
And then set up eventually in Knoxville, creating Tennessee's first newspaper. He was brought over by John Sevier, one of our first governors.
Mm-hmm.
And Sevier knew our territorial governor. He knew the importance of having a newspaper on his side.
Talk to us about some of your other areas, your passions.
One of my favorite objects in the collection is a dresser made by a man named Lewis Buckner out of Sevier County in East Tennessee. And Lewis Buckner was enslaved as a child in Jefferson County. And then after emancipation, he was trained by this man named Christian Stump. And Christian Stump came to Tennessee from Michigan. He was a Union veteran who settled in East Tennessee and trained Buckner in the art of cabinet making. And Buckner goes on to establish his own wide-based clientele. And he is very renowned in his community. He made furniture and did outdoor architectural elements for both white and black clients.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a bed and dresser suite upstairs showing Buckner's work. What I love about Buckner is the context of what's going on during his lifetime. So our furniture that we have upstairs was made in 1889. During that same time, there are sweeping voter restriction laws being passed against African Americans. And Buckner is on record as having registered to vote. So in the face of those restrictions, he's still pushing for his own rights in his own community.
Very, very interesting. And what town did he live in again?
He lived in Sevierville, okay. In Sevier County,
right.
Where Dolly Parton is from.
Yeah, and the craftsmanship, the detail, the intricacies.
So many symbols in that furniture. You've got fans, you've got different geometric elements, you've got vegetables. So you've got an eggplant showing in the pediment of those pieces. Eggplants are a staple in African American cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
So it's also known as guinea squash. So you've got Buckner touching the aesthetic style of the time. He's creating furniture in this very popular aesthetic movement style, but then he's bringing in his own natural elements that he would see in his own own home.
And again, I would challenge any woodworker, craftsman today to try to come close
right.
to his refined, just beautiful works of art.
Right. You really have to see it in person to appreciate. So please come to the museum and come see this Buckner furniture. It's hard to describe.
Yeah, worth a trip to Tennessee in its own right. Okay, more fun stuff.
We also have a flight suit that was worn by a woman named Doris Tanner out of West Tennessee. She was from Obion County. She actually was a school teacher in Haywood County in Brownsville. But during World War II, she enlisted to become a woman Air Force service pilot. What that means is that she trained in Texas in all of the ways that male service pilots were trained. She flew over 80 different types of planes. She carried servicemen to different bases throughout the country. And in doing that, although they were working on the home front, they freed up the male pilots to go abroad and serve. And so she served from 1942 to 1944 when they're known as WASPs, when the WASPs disbanded. And then in the 1970s, she helped advocate for them to get veteran status.
That's so cool. My heroes, amazing. I knew a couple. I told you the one that was so petite, they had to strap on wood blocks on the rudder pedals so she could reach, so she could fly the B-24 bomber across the country.
Amazing. Anything it took to get the job done.
Yeah, so cool. And then they had to all go back home after the war.
Right, and had to go back to a normal life. I know Doris Tanner talks about how that was kind of depressing for her because she was used to all the excitement and getting to go out and be her own person. So, but they did what they had to do.
Yep. Okay, more fun stuff.
Another one I really like is the Nancy Reese sampler. So a sampler is an embroidered textile. And the one that we have is, like I said, made by Nancy Reese, who is a Cherokee woman from the Chattanooga area. The one in the State Museum is actually the earliest known Cherokee sampler. And she made it in 1823 when she was about 8 years old.
Wow.
And she did that at an American mission called the Brainerd Mission. So a lot of Christian missionaries would set up mission schools around Native American communities to try to Americanize them, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
And so would try to teach them in Western education. So that's where Nancy and her brothers went. And she, as a young woman, marries another Native American man named Joseph Starr. And in the 1830s, they're among the first group of Native American detachments to be forcibly removed from East Chattanooga area in Tennessee to Oklahoma as part mm-hmm. of the Trail of Tears.
Yeah.
And during their journey, the man who was their, quote, conductor, that's what the leader was called, kept a journal, and which was very common. It helped inform the next detachment what to watch out for. And in his journal, he says, Joseph Starr's wife had a child last night. So Nancy Reese had her first child on the Trail of Tears after walking over a dozen miles and then had to walk a dozen miles the next day to keep going on their journey. So, but like I said, an object telling this huge story literally within the threads of the sampler.
Okay, one more.
And the last one we can talk about, which is a smaller object, but I think has a really interesting story, is a sheriff badge used by this female sheriff named Della Riley, and she's from Claiborne County, also in East Tennessee. And in the 1930s, she's elected as the first female sheriff in Tennessee, 1932. She does come on the heels of her husband, who was also a sheriff, so there's a little favoritism there. But she is the first female elected sheriff, and she served a two-year term. And the first year of her tenure, she had to catch a father-son duo who were murderers. And so a wealthy, reclusive farmer in her community was killed. And so nothing ever happened in Claiborne County. And so she was tasked with finding these murderers, mm-hmm. and she worked with the Knoxville police, and they caught them. And the whole event was really exciting for that community. And so it was profiled in true crime magazines, national true crime magazines of the time. So it kind of shows that even then we had a fascination with true crime stories.
Sounds like it's ripe for a Hollywood movie.
It really is.
Yeah. Okay, going back to 1915, right around the corner in town, there was a motor car parade of young women suffragettes.
Yes.
This was a real cutting-edge area for the suffragette movement.
It really is. So in 1919, American women get the right to vote, but Tennessee was the last state who really helped seal the deal for women's suffrage.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why Tennessee is called the Perfect 36, and Nashville was the hub for that. There are women across the state who are advocating for that, like Ida B. Wells in Memphis, and you've got Mary Church Terrell in Memphis. You've got a lot of women in Nashville especially, but they come to Nashville since it's in the center of the state and work out of the Hermitage Hotel in Nashville and, like you said, are parading, advocating for their right to vote. So, and they help sway Harry Byrne with the Tennessee General Assembly. He's that deciding vote. And his mother writes him a letter saying, you know, mother wants you to do this. It's the right thing to do. And
cool.
He casts that vote.
All right. Mother's rule
right.
Once again.
But it took the strength of women across Tennessee to get that for us, mm-hmm. for the women of the country.
Before you go, let's talk a moment about Civil War in Tennessee. That's one of your areas of specialty.
Right. So Tennessee was a divided state during the Civil War. I don't know how many people are aware of that, but it really was. East Tennessee had a stronghold of Union support. There were pockets of Confederate support, but West Tennessee had the strongest area of Confederate support, and Middle Tennessee was more or less the most divided.
And, you know, the metaphor for that dichotomy has everything to do with agricultural or non-agricultural basis community.
Right. So with West Tennessee being more ripe for plantations, for farms, it's natural that there's going to be more enslaved people there to be that free labor. And so those farmers, the ones that are slaveholders, are trying to keep that support, to keep that free labor. Mm-hmm. And but eventually Tennessee does vote to secede from the Union. And we've got a whole gallery dedicated to this very complex story upstairs. And one of the objects upstairs that I, again, a part of decorative arts, but telling a Civil War story, is a jar by a man named Christopher Hahn, who was a Unionist out of East Tennessee. And he was part of a group of bridge burners who burned bridges anticipating a Confederate arrival in their community, and they were trying to support the Union soldiers. In doing so, he was actually executed for his, quote, crime. And the only reason we're able to attribute this jar, which is signed with his initials, to the actual man is because of a letter he wrote his wife saying, you know, please sell my tools to support yourself once I'm gone. And it connects that story. But all of this very complex story of Tennessee, we're trying to tell into the galleries.
And another disconnect people don't readily realize is the state of Tennessee was really in the forefront in certain areas in the abolitionist movement. In Jonesboro, the first abolitionist newspaper in America,
right,
dating from, what, 1820?
I would think so. I'm not as familiar with that part of Jonesboro's story, but we have 95 counties, so I'm still trying to catch up.
But isn't that amazing?
It is. So, I mean, Tennessee is really, like we were talking about earlier, it's kind of the story of America, somewhat. All of these different pockets of history going on within this one state.
All right. Well, I've got to come back because we just scratched the surface of the outside of Tennessee State Museum. You really need to plan on 2 days here,
I think.
Just to get the basics.
And we do have tours, so I don't necessarily give the tours, but we have great education staff who give great tours for people that want that in-depth story.
Okay. For the listener to learn more,
they can go to tnmuseum.org. And you can see a selected group of objects that have been highlighted within the galleries. You can read stories written by different staff members, and then you can find out how to reach us.
I love it. What a great day. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's been wonderful.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by the Foundation at Hearst Castle, where donors and members experience exclusive events that recreate what it was like to be a guest of William Randolph Hearst, from swimming in the iconic Neptune Pool to dining in Hearst's private guesthouse overlooking the Pacific Ocean. The Foundation at Hearst Castle's ongoing mission is to support the conservation and restoration of Hearst Castle while offering youth programs for underserved students, preserving the past and inspiring future generations of dreamers. These children experience a world of science, technology, engineering, art, and math at Hearst Castle STEAM, along with studying the legacy of Julia Morgan, one of the most important women in the history of engineering and architecture. The foundation at Hearst Castle not only changes the lives of children, but also provides lifetime memories and unrivaled experiences for our generous donors and members. Discover how you can become a member by going to foundation@hearstcastle.com and learn how you can support this unique and invaluable mission. You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.